by the name of Mission America came to New York. Mission America I had never heard of before this, but it is a network of about 400 of the major evangelical ministries in America. Ministries like World Vision and Billy Graham Association and Campus Crusade for Christ and Focus on the Family and, you know, that the kind of ministries that we've all heard of, and they have their own unique identities. But they've come together under the umbrella of Mission America for the purposes of evangelism. And so they have an annual conference every year, and in 2003, they decided to do their conference in New York. And they invited youth workers to have a place at the table. The theme for the conference was the gospel in the city. Their goal was to convene, all sorts of ministers from around the country, but specifically for the youth track, urban youth ministers, to come and explore the impact that evangelical Christianity has in the urban context. And they asked youth workers, or they gave us, I should say, a lot of freedom to ask some provocative questions. And so the host committee, which I was part of, we responded to Mission America and said, look, if you want a how-to conference on how to do urban youth ministry, we're not the guys for that. You know, we're basically, because for a lot of us, our operating assumption is that what we're doing is not working. Right? What evangelicals are doing to reach urban young people, by and large, is not working very effectively. And you don't have to look much further than the TV set or turn on the radio to understand that. Listen to any pop radio station, turn on MTV, watch network television, and you find real quickly that for the most part, evangelical Christianity that we embrace is irrelevant to pop culture. You don't have to, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not some huge revelation that's come from any empirical study. It's just a fact, and you see it every time you put on the television, listen to popular entertainment. There are some anomalies to that. The Passion of the Christ, you know, that was a pretty remarkable thing. But it's interesting that the Passion of the Christ was not produced by an evangelical minister. It's fascinating to me that what Billy Graham called the equivalent of a lifetime of his messages, what most evangelicals were calling the greatest tool for evangelism of our day, was produced by a Catholic Hollywood actor. It was not produced by an evangelist. It was not produced by an evangelical. It was produced by a Catholic actor who's got a passion for the cross and wanted to communicate that passion, who incidentally earned the right to be heard because he's built a career as a credible actor, a credible filmmaker. And because of that, when he said he was going to make the Passion of the Christ, people's curiosity was inspired. They wanted to come and see that. So anyway, in the Mission America conference, we came back and said, look, if you're willing to allow us to spend 10 hours wrestling with why evangelical Christianity is irrelevant to pop culture, and not just bash the church, because that's not the point, but to see what is it about the truth that we embrace that's distinguishable from the traditions that we practice, what's inherent in the message that we preach that's different than the methods that we promote, that might actually take our expressions of ministry from irrelevant to revolutionary. Something that'll transform our communities, transform lives. How can we do that? And so Mission America said, fine. And they allowed us to design a 10 hours over 2 days where we wrestled with that main question. And as we did, it was amazing because there were 15 youth workers from around the country. About 25 of them were from New York, who got in a room. The New York crew, a lot of us knew each other, but the people from outside were new to us, we were new to them, they were new to each other. So for the most part, we weren't folks that had pre-established relationships, We weren't from the same streams of thought or discussion. We didn't attend all the same conferences. But when we put our, you know, when we got in the room and began to dialogue, it was amazing the similarities of experience and the consensus that emerged out of the discussion. And what I want to do today is present some of that consensus. We've distributed an article that was written shortly after the Mission America deal, which you can take. You don't need to refer to that now, but it will summarize a lot of what we're discussing. If you attended the workshop yesterday, What Would Jay-Z Do? Some of what we're going to talk about today is an extension of that. If you weren't there, don't worry. It's not like that's a prerequisite to today. And then the same thing last night. Some of the themes that we talked about in the Place of Hope presentation will reemerge here. But what I want to spend our time with, I'm tripping over this cord, it's taking a look at the methods of Jesus' ministry that transform the world. When you consider the fact that Jesus, by any modern evangelical standard, was a failure, or at best he was a mediocre evangelist. Just looking at the 3 years of his ministry, he begins at the age of 30, he calls 12 followers to himself, 3 years later one of them's betrayed him, had him executed on the cross. On the night of his betrayal, the 11 who didn't turn him in all abandoned him. Peter, who was closest to him, denied him, pretended he didn't even know him. Sure, he spoke to multitudes at different times, but he didn't have a huge following. I mean, you think about the multitudes that he spoke to weren't there saying, "Crucify Barabbas." You know, this was the community that supposedly had embraced him, abandoned him. The end of his ministry was a colossal failure. It was the most humiliating of all sorts of, you know, kinds of outcomes, was to be crucified. The indignity of crucifixion, to hang naked on a cross, beaten beyond all recognition. Imagine the pain of this. And yet somehow within those 3 years, Jesus did something that allowed for a world change. The world is not the same. You and I are here because of what Jesus practiced in 3 years of ministry. We're going to come back to that, but before we do, let me explain what these pictures are. I have some pictures on a slideshow. I think I fixed the problem yesterday when it shut off if you were in the session. So they should be running throughout. What these are just random photographs of the youth ministry that I direct in New York City. You'll see all kinds of shots in here. Some of them are outdoor outreach events, carnivals, basketball tournaments, that kind of thing. Some of them, like this one, are theater productions that are after-school programs put on. You'll have after-school shots. You'll have church worship shots. We run two youth centers in partnership with a local church, and they've become feeders for unsaved kids into the community of the church. And so there are kids getting baptized and kids at altar calls and kids praying for each other. And most of these kids began their spiritual journey fresh, meaning they're not coming from other churches. They're kids that have grown up in godless home situations, but who have met Jesus as a result of the principles that we're going to talk about today. And to illustrate the principle, even before we get there, I'm going to start with a little story. 1994 or 93. My dad's church, where I was, we planted the church in 92. You know, being his son, I was part of that church planting team, whether I wanted to be or not. But I wanted to be. It was something I enjoyed and a community that I loved. So we started the church in 92. In the summer of 93, we were having an outreach, as we often do. And this one particular night, there was a huge fire around the corner from where we were doing a street meeting. And I went and I, you know, took some pictures that night. Well, the following day, I wanted to go back and take pictures of the aftermath of the fire. And so I walked over, I borrowed a couple cameras because I didn't own my own. But I borrowed two cameras and went and I started taking shots of this fire. And it was about three blocks from where we were going to do the outreach that Saturday afternoon. We had a block party going on 6th Street right outside of the church. We shut down the street and we're, you know, have free food and games and music. And it was a relational kind of an outreach. So I went to 4th Street where this fire had taken place, took some pictures. On my way back, I passed a stoop where there were about 5 or 6 kids tossing a football around. Now, 10 years ago, or more than that, 12 years ago, I was about 50 pounds lighter than I am right now, so a skinny, relatively tall, white kid in a predominantly Latino and African-American neighborhood. These were all Hispanic kids and tossing a football around. And as I approached, it was painfully obvious that the skinny white kid was the funniest thing they had seen in a really long time. You ever feel that way? Right? You're just walking down the street and you know that the eyes are like penetrating you. You can't quite make out what they're saying, but it's obvious you're the subject of whatever they're talking about. Well, that's how I felt. And this afternoon, as I'm walking, the first thing in my mind was, you have two cameras around your neck that don't belong to you, and a brand new pair of sneakers on your feet that you just barely started to wear. Cross the street and avoid a bad situation. And that was my instinctive response, was, you know what, this is not a good thing, let me cross the street. But in my heart, I got convicted. I knew that that was not what God would do in that situation. So I said a quick prayer, God, don't let me make a fool of myself. And then I proceeded to do just that. I walked up to them and I said, are you guys hungry? First words out of my mouth, I'm not sure why. They didn't come from here, that's for sure. But I think they were divine because they looked at me like, you know, I had just confirmed their suspicion that I was the most comical thing they had ever seen. And I said, well, we're having a block party on 6th Street. There'll be food, games, music. Why don't you come and join us? And they looked at me and said, well, is the food free? Yeah, it's free. We've got hot dogs and stuff. Come and enjoy as much as you'd like. And then I took off, hoping that they would ignore me, not take up the invitation, and leave me alone. But they followed me. So now we're walking the distance. They're probably, you know, 20 paces or so behind me. I'm convinced the football is going to smack me in the back of my head. Thankfully, it didn't happen. They came to the block party. They spent the afternoon. We ended up playing basketball, showed them the church, had a great day. Well, about a year later, I was volunteering at a neighborhood youth center. And this kid walks in who looked so familiar to me. I knew him from somewhere, but I couldn't quite place it. I didn't really think much of it. It was a Christian youth center. There were a team of 4 of us that every Friday night would facilitate a Bible study. This particular night, 2 of the 4 weren't there. It was myself and another guy, and neither one of us were prepared. And so we went in the back. We said, you know what, should we just let the kids play some games tonight? And, you know, we'll call it fellowship and have a great time. Well, he had been reading a passage that I was familiar with. We both were convicted. Now, let's have our Bible study and, you know, see where it goes. Well, we did that, and the familiar face raised his hand at the end to receive Jesus, him and 3 other boys. And they started coming to the church, not because they wanted to come to church, but because one of the pretty girls from the church invited them to come. She, as it turned out, never even came back to the church. It was like bait and switch. But she had invited them. They came on Sunday. And out of those 4 kids, the familiar face kept coming. He was coming all the time. Now, he was not the easiest kid in the world to get along with. You know, he had a strong personality, very opinionated, no inhibitions about confronting you if that's what he felt like he wanted to do at any given moment. But he was coming to church, and he came consistently until the summertime hit. Once the summertime hit and the girl started wearing fewer clothing, and the beaches and the pools were open, he decided he had had enough of church. He wanted to go hang out at the pool with the chicken heads. That's what he called them. And so we didn't see him for a while, but we maintained a relationship with him. Whenever there was something happening that we thought he'd be interested in, we'd make it a point to call him and invite him. Rarely would he come, but on occasion he would. Like, he came to the Super Bowl party, and he came to one of the NBA Finals games that we watched in the church basement. And so he'd pop in and out, but he came to the basketball tournament that summer. But really, for the most part, it dropped out of everything we were doing. Then he found out we were going on a youth retreat, and he saw that as a free vacation. So he called up and he said, could he go? And I said, well, at that point we were full, but if you want, bring a bag, and if we can squeeze another person into the van, you're happy to come with us. So he came, and on this youth retreat, he rededicated his heart to the Lord. Well, a couple weeks later, I was still puzzled by the fact that his face was so familiar, and I couldn't ever place why. Like, why did I know him? And then it dawned on me one day to take out a package of photographs that I had taken two summers earlier with a borrowed camera around my neck. And I realized that this familiar face was the ringleader of the group of kids that I nearly crossed the street to avoid two summers earlier. He was the one, out of all of them, that was the most intimidating of the bunch, because he was the most opinionated and the most outspoken and the most obnoxious and the one that, you know, I could kind of hear him. I couldn't hear everybody else. So I knew what was going on, and I nearly crossed the street to avoid him just two summers earlier. And now he was a spiritual fruit of our ministry. Well, fast forward a couple months. This was like the winter of whenever. Doesn't really matter. A year and a half after this block party. And within the next 4 months, Rolly had brought four of the five kids who were hanging out on the stoop, who came to the church, gave their heart to the Lord. Two of them, Rolly and Lubox, a year after that, were co-founders with me of Generation Excel. These are the kids that we were able to reach because of a free hot dog. That at the end of the day, what brought them to the Lord was a free hot dog. That's not a bad trade-off, right? Well, today, Rolly is a graduate of Nyack College. He's married, he has two children, and he directs programs at New Life Youth Center, which is the youth center where we ran the Bible study that he raised his hand to receive Jesus at. And he still, to this day, is bringing kids to Abounding Grace from New Life Youth Center. Lewis, who was one of the other boys that was tossing the football around that afternoon, just last week graduated from Nyack College with a degree in youth ministry. Lubox, let me tell you about him for a second. Lewis, when he was 12 years old, had a defining moment in his life. His father was a drug abuser, an alcoholic, and when he would get intoxicated, he'd turn violent. And so Lewis grew up in a very violent home. Normally what he would do when his dad was in these rages was hide in his bedroom, but when he was 12, you know, he started to muster the courage on occasion to confront his father. And this one afternoon, he was hiding in his bedroom as mom and dad were outside, and it was a nasty fight. Lute says he heard the punches hitting his mom's body, you know, the glasses breaking, all that kind of stuff. And for the first time, in the heat of a battle like that, he had the courage to leave his room and confront his dad. So he came out of the room swinging. Hit his dad a couple times, his father's eye caught his eye, and he realized what was going on. So at that point, he left. It was the last time Lewis ever saw his dad, because a couple days later, got a phone call that his father was found hanging in the basement of a nearby building. He had committed suicide. So Lou, as a teenager, lived with that guilt. When I met Lou that summer, you know, with the hot dog stuff, by that point, he was running the streets. He and some of his friends had started a little crew they called Sex, Booze, and Money. That was all they aspired to, pretty much. He was recycling his dad's stuff, you know, abusing alcohol, smoking weed, experimenting with harder drugs, but, you know, he was still fairly young, so it was mainly alcohol and weed at that point, but very sexually active, just totally living the street life. We met him with a free hot dog. It took 2 years until he gave his heart to the Lord. Well, when we decided to start a youth center, he was one of the kids that wanted to do it. Except there was an issue with Lou. He was still drinking. And he was unreliable. He had met Jesus, but on occasion he'd show up to things drunk. That summer when we opened the youth center, we had a softball program. And Lou, besides being one of the co-founders of Excel, was one of the assistant coaches for the softball program. And he would show up typically an hour late to games because he was hungover. You know, an 8:30 Saturday morning game when you've been out drinking all night is not an easy start time, and so he very rarely was there on time. But Lou, there was something about Lou, because despite all that, he loved Jesus. Well, Louis co-founded Excel. We walked through all this stuff. He was a volunteer, part-time staff, intern, full-time staff, program staff, all these amazing things. 2 years ago, he decided once and for all that he needed to finish college. He had been attending college in the city, and so he was taking the long road. You know, he'd go for a semester, take a semester off, change majors every couple of days, didn't really know what he wanted to do. And so by then he had been in school for about 4 years. We helped him get through high school, help him get into college. He decided he wanted to finish. And so in December, he made a decision. He was going to the upstate campus. He attended Nyack College. They've got a campus in the city and a campus about an hour north of the city. So he was going to leave the city. So we had a going away party for Lewis. Lewis, in the going away party, you know, I was there. I was expecting, of course, the kids to say great things. Lou is the most tenured member of our staff from the beginning. He'd had so many different roles, originated so many different programs. I had no doubt the response was going to be good. But I stood in the back of the room and I watched as one after another, about five or six different kids got up and they described Lou not as being a great friend, not as being a big brother, not as being a cool recreation director or any of those things. Each one of these kids described Lewis as being a father to them. They themselves are fatherless. Now, remember, 10 years earlier, Lou's dad killed himself. A fatherless kid had become a father to other fatherless kids. Something happened to Lou because he was given a shot even as he was struggling with booze. Even as he was unreliable and unpredictable, something happened. He met a guy named Jesus. He ran into Jesus in the person of a community of believers that were willing to extend grace to him in the midst of his sin, that were willing to extend mercy to him even as he screwed up time and time again. Now, Lewis just graduated from college. It's amazing to me. 10 years ago, nobody would have expected that Lou would ever call himself a college graduate. But not only is he a father to fatherless kids, but he's got a college degree. And he's got big dreams today. Whereas 10 years ago, all his dreams consisted of were sex, booze, and money. His perspective has changed. That's the kind of revolution that impassions me. That's what, you know, it's like that 180 switch of a kid who's in a dead-end road, consumed by pain, hurt, desperation, abandonment, rejection, all of that crap, who goes from that place of hopelessness to a place of fulfillment and recognizing that there's a call of God on my life. Despite all the pain, God has met me where I'm at, and He's doing something in my life. That's the kind of revolution that I want to talk about tonight. There were five major points of agreement that flew out of the conversation. Whether you were from Generation Excel at Alphabet City, like I'm from, or from California, or from Minnesota, or from Chicago, and we're at Dallas, wherever the people came from who were at this conversation. The first conclusion, didn't matter what we were talking about, everybody always came back to this point. It's all about relationships. Ministry is not about a budget. It's not. Now, I know what it's like to not have money and do ministry. When we started Generation Excel, 13 kids, primarily from the projects, no money, no space, no equipment, no paid staff. We had no budget. All we had were kids who had made a decision to start a program. There were 13 of us. I was 21 and the oldest member of our team. Most of our kids were like Lou or like Mei Ling, who also just graduated last week from NYU with a nursing degree. But at the time, she was living with her mom who was dying of AIDS. She had grown up in a situation filled with drug abuse and prostitution, was actually removed from her home, didn't really know her dad, lived in Puerto Rico with foster parents. Her mom met Jesus, was able to got clean and sober. Mei Ling and her sister moved back in. But by the time I met her, you know, her mom was on her way out and actually died when Mei Ling was 16. But she's one of our co-founders too. I mean, that was the kind of kid that we were working with. They wanted to start. We had no money to bring to the table, but we had kids. And when you've got a group of kids, you can change the world. When you have a group of people, and that's the first point I want to draw you to. Matthew chapter 4, if you have your Bibles. Jesus is just beginning his ministry. He's been, you know, he's had his wilderness experience. He's come through that. He's declared publicly his mission statement. And in verse 18, as Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will make you fishers of men." At once they left their nets and followed him. His first thing as he started his ministry was to pull together people that he could invest his life into. He got a bunch of guys that were just ordinary folks and said, "Let me give you everything I have." Ministry is about relationship. The greatest commandment, the lawyer came to trap Jesus and said, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" "How do you read what the law says?" Jesus responded, "Love the Lord your God with everything you have and love your neighbor as yourself. Do this and you will live," was Jesus' response. When I read a verse like that, "Do this and you will live," I pay attention to that. Because I want the abundant life that Jesus promised. And what he said to do is not that complicated. It's love God with everything you have and love people as you love yourself. That's not so deep, and we overcomplicate things. But that's the essence of ministry. It's all about relationships. The next thing that we looked at was the fact that within our evangelical traditions, the part of why we've become so irrelevant is because we have this condescending approach towards kids that treats them as if they're the future. I'm not going to belabor this point because I mentioned it last night. Young people are not the future. That's a myth that handicaps the church and their ability to connect with kids. They're not. David was not the future when he confronted Goliath. He was a kid who had heart, who had passion, and was given a platform to do what God had called him to do. Whether man recognized it or not, God had a divine calling on his life. And he got the platform, he was released to walk in that calling, and he took out the giant. One guy had paralyzed the army for 40 days. This kid had the guts to look him in the eyes because he understood who he was in relationship to his God. So that was the second thing we talked about. It's exploding that myth. Get rid of the idea that young people are the future. It's condescending. It's paternalistic. It ghettoizes them. You know, the implication, if you tell somebody that they're the future, it demeans their present. It discounts their past. Well, every kid comes with baggage. And so, what is their past? How has that affected their today? But what is God saying about their future? And how does that affect their today? Let's give them a place to be able to do what God has called them to do. The third was empowering those kids, recognizing that if God has called them right now, that doesn't mean they know everything. They've got all the, they might think they have all the answers. We want to give them an opportunity to discover the answers. But at the end of the day, you do that by empowering leadership, empowering development. One of the things, as we were talking about, there was an agreement that most youth ministry is conceived, planned, organized, executed by adults, by well-meaning adults. I have news for you. As well-meaning as we are, if we tell a kid that this is cool, how do they respond? It can't be cool. If you think it's cool, it ain't cool. But if their friend tells them it's cool, it's cool. That's what they're looking for. And so you empower kids to reach kids. How do you do that? How did Jesus do it? He called 12 guys. He said, follow me. Follow, learn from me. Let's walk this journey together. He was present and involved in their lives. Turn to Matthew chapter 11. I mean 10. He called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. These are the names of the 12 apostles. First Simon, and it lists all of them. Verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. As you go, preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. He said, I've invested in you. I've poured my life into you. Go ahead and reciprocate. Pour your life into somebody else. He didn't babysit them. He gave them the opportunity based upon the investment that he made. He knew that they had something in them. But then he had to release them. He had to release them, recognizing that they might very well screw up. Have you ever had a kid you've entrusted with responsibility fall through? Well, that was Lou when he'd show up an hour and a half late to a softball game that ran 2 hours. You know, that's part of the experience. But that's part of empowerment. It's not that you gloss over it and pretend like he was on time. No, you got to deal with that. But at the same time that you interact, because it's out of relationship, you're not just the judge in the chamber that they're coming to get disciplined. You're somebody that loves them. It's demonstrated love for them. And so that kind of thing can evolve naturally out of the experience. Next, we explored the fact that empowerment flows out of mentoring kinds of relationships. Mentoring that's not programmatic. Mentoring's a buzzword. It's become trendy. There's all sorts of money for mentoring programs. I'm convinced, you know, money's a good thing. Please don't misunderstand me. Money can fuel a lot, you know, can help with organization and structure and stuff. But oftentimes, my experience, my observation is that when money enters the mentoring equation, it stops being mentoring. You know, you create these weird artificial kind of relationships, and it might happen to a degree just because it has to log the hours or something. But that kind of relationship doesn't really unfold itself. Well, Jesus was a mentor. What happened? After he sent the disciples out, they came back and he talked to them. They debriefed. They examined what worked, what didn't work. How did it go for you in this town? What were your experiences? He was able to share in their joy, not just discipline them when they screwed up, but embrace their joy, celebrate it together. And then lastly, we talked about how if you're going to engage, if you're going to be involved in youth ministry, you have to be willing to engage the culture. It can't be the kind of thing where, you know, you just come because you have all the answers and your job is to help kids understand your lifestyle. No, it's understanding their language. It's communicating in their terms. What was the analogy that Jesus used when he called Peter and Andrew? It was an analogy of a fisherman. Fishermen, we talked in yesterday's workshop about what that means. But in a nutshell, fishing is a messy job. It smells bad. It's dangerous. You go out into the deep. You don't fish in an aquarium. You fish in the sea. You have to bring bait with you to be an effective fisherman. Fish aren't signing up to jump in the boat. You've got to go after them and catch them. And when you do, things get messy and gory. You know, it's like, there's a lot of blood on fishing boats. You know, a lot of mess and foul odors and all kinds of stuff. That's part of the job description of a fisherman. That's what we've been called to do. Engaging culture, understanding language, communicating relevantly can get messy. When issues stop being taboo and kids come and they start talking about lust, not in like the watered down version that we do in our churches, but when they start talking about lust, you can't avoid MTV anymore. You just can't, because video girls are all over the place and boys struggle with that. And sometimes it gets messy. The way they communicate that is not pretty. Their struggles are real. Kids are getting pregnant on a regular basis. And if they're not doing that, they're doing other stuff. The minefield of the mind. You know, the things that they're battling with. Sometimes you deal with these issues and it's uncomfortable for you. It's not uncomfortable for them because that's their reality. And we've got to connect with them on that term. Not to water down truth, but to bring truth as a light in that kind of a situation. As we move to that place, kids like Lou start sobering up. They begin to set aside their sexual promiscuity. They might still struggle, but you're walking with them in the journey. So now they've got somebody to be accountable to. Somebody who's not going to beat them down when the temptations arise. They're not going to beat them down because, you know, maybe they messed up on some level. And you're going to extend grace and you're going to extend mercy. And over the course of time, Jesus in 3 years took 12 guys that had no prior relationship with this. They were tax collectors. They were political revolutionaries. One of them, Simon, called the Zealot. The Zealots were bad dudes, man. I mean, some today, they were like the Chays of their day. You know, they were zealots, political zealots. They wanted a violent military overthrow of the kingdom. He embraced Simon the Zealot. He embraced a guy that he knew was going to betray him. He had a traitor in his midst. The traitor went out with the instructions of preaching. Jesus wasn't surprised that Judas betrayed him. And yet he embraced him into the community, invested his life as much into Judas as into Peter or John. When we're in youth ministry, there's an acknowledgement that some of our kids are going to walk away. But we do it anyway because God loved them anyway. Jesus died on the cross knowing full well that not everybody he died for was going to receive the grace that was offered to them. When that becomes central to our DNA, youth ministry becomes revolutionary. Because it's not about money, it's not about programs, it's not about spaces, it's not about physical locations. All of those things are great as tools to engage kids. But with or without that stuff, kids are kids. And they're looking for somebody who's going to love and embrace them, pour their life into them. 12 relationships was all Jesus needed to change the world. You and I are fruit of those 12 relationships. We worship. We come to a place like this. Our lives have been transformed by grace. because of 12 guys that Jesus poured his life into. When you're in ministry and you get seduced by the sexiness of numbers, remember that Jesus didn't have a whole lot of numbers. He had a small group ministry, like a lot of our urban youth ministries. It was a small group, but in that small group of guys that he poured every ounce of himself into over a 3-year period, when he was gone, they were empowered to change the world. The others that were associated, maybe not as intimately, I think, what was it, 144 that were in the upper room? That's not a huge group of people. They were filled with the Spirit, and they took it wherever God sent them. And as they took his presence with them, they were able to reproduce the relationships that Jesus invested in them, and they changed the world. I'm going to shut up now. We've got about, I think, 25 minutes or so for some discussion. And I'd like to open it up because I want to learn from you, hear from you, learn from each other. What's your experience been like in youth ministry? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you can relate to, that you disagree with? Where are you in this irrelevant to revolutionary quest that we're all on some level?
One thing you mentioned that I've had nothing but struggle with is kids do fail you, or when they fail themselves and they show up and something's wrong, or someone's bloody and fighting. Where is that fine line between letting them know that you still affirm them, their grace is still there? But sometimes, you know, a lot of people in their lives, especially schools in our area, there's no accountability. Mm-hmm. And so being someone who can let them know, no, that is not cool, mm-hmm. you need to change your behavior. But at the same time, I'm doing this out of love, the grace is still there. In the early stages of the relationship, that communication has been a total struggle.
Does anyone want to respond to that? The question for the benefit of the CD is, where do you draw the line between affirming kids who screw up and at the same time helping them to deal with the consequences in a constructive way? Is that a good interpretation of the question? Anybody have a thought on that?
Instead of, if they know they're late, or they know they're drunk, or they know they, I mean, they're not stupid. They know those things, and it's huge. Like, they don't have anyone to listen to them. And obviously, that's what we're talking about, is building these relationships, building these relationships. So even in the midst of, like, you disappointed me, or you disappointed yourself, like, making sure that you're still building a relationship by listening to, like, well, what's their story? Why did this happen? There's usually a why. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like, there's something behind. Because they know they're going to dysfunction. And so why would they compromise that, kind of? And so there's usually a why. And, I mean, I completely agree with her as well, like, saying there does still need to be some sort of consequence. But I think before the consequence is laid out, before it's, like, if he had, you know, is on them, just to say, like, I'm really sad that, like, you know, you weren't here. Like, what happened? Why did it? Like, what's going on? And then it'll give you the opportunity and a platform, actually, I think, to talk to them about it and to be building that relationship while they're continuing to love. Because it shows, like, you care about the why. Where usually, like, people at work, they're not going to care. Like she said, they're not going to get paid. Like, the parents might not care. Like, or the school, yeah, you'll fail. You know? And so they just need someone to listen to the. You need someone to listen
to them. I mean, I think that's a lot of the problems. They just need someone to listen to them. They're kind of crying out a lot of times in those situations. I think also, the kids need to know that you believe that they can do it. Like, some kids say things like, well, I can't help it. And we lower our standards of what we expect out of them. Like the world does, oh, that's because they have this environment, that's because of this. But I find when we tell the kids, no, I know you can do it. That's why I should tell you, because I know that you can go and walk away from that fight. Because you're stronger than that. And we get that lots of positive affirmation, and the kids are like, I am stronger than that. And they realize, they see the positive instead of the negative, like, I mean, this is the right too. And that is, like, before even giving them a job, just expect them. They need to know we expect them before, and not, well, we just expect them to show up on time, but tell them why. They need to understand that and know, well, you're really important. You are essential for doing whatever in this ministry. We really need you because you're awesome. And it changes their whole attitude and outlook. And a lot of times they'll think twice before doing something stupid.
Now, I think, too, looking back at how Jesus dealt with his disciples when they screwed up, because they did, you know, and I'm reminded, for instance, of Peter, who he was an amazing guy, but just as spectacular as his successes were, so too his failures. And Jesus never beat around the bush with Peter when he messed up. You know, he allowed him to deal with the consequences. In fact, there were occasions when he told him in advance exactly what the consequence would be. And Peter did it anyway. For instance, the night of Jesus' betrayal and crucifixion. He said, surely tonight you're going to betray me 3 times before the cock crows. He told them straight out what was going to happen. He did it anyway. The cock crowed, and then he fell broken. And Jesus could have beat him down, because how could you do that? Didn't you know where I was? And you left me hanging? You know, didn't you know what I was going through? And all I needed was your presence, and it would have gotten me through. What were you doing? Telling people you didn't know me? He could have gone that route. But instead, he welcomed Peter back. And you remember, after he had resurrected, but the disciples were back out fishing again. Remember that? They were out fishing. And they fished all night and caught nothing. And Jesus shows up on the shore and he's preparing some food. But before they make their way back, he calls out to them. And he said, hey, how's the fishing today? Terrible, we didn't catch anything. Cast your net on the other side of the boat. That wasn't the first time that Jesus told them to do that. That was how he got Peter in the first place. It was the same trickery, method, whatever you want to call it. He said, cast your net on the other side of the boat. That, I think, was more for Peter than for anybody else. To let Peter know, I'm still the same God who loved you before you betrayed me. And then, when he came back and they sat there and ate together, Jesus spoke to Peter directly and said, Peter, do you love me? Three times he asked the question. He came back because he knew that Peter was questioning. I think that was more for Peter than that was for him. But he extended the grace for Peter to be able to understand just how much he was forgiven. Just how much he was welcomed back. Yeah, he had a horrible 3 nights or 4 nights or 5, however many nights it was, from the time of the denials until this reconciliation took place. But Jesus made sure that the reconciliation happened. He extended grace. Let him deal with the consequences, but walk through the consequences with them. You know, let them know there's a price to pay, but I'm still available to you. I'm not going anywhere. And we'll keep this relationship moving. Any other questions or thoughts? The issue is the volunteers. How do you recruit volunteers? Let me ask you a question. How many volunteers did Jesus have at the start of his ministry? None. There was one guy with 12 kids, and what did he do? He taught them how to be their own volunteers. Jesus took the 12 people he was investing in and put them on the front lines. Said, you guys, hey, you feed 5,000 people. And they're how are you asking me to feed 5,000 people? I don't have money. We're in the middle of the desert. You want me to find food for 5,000? Jesus gave them an opportunity to fix that problem. They couldn't come up with it. But as they were talking, this little kid overhears and says, I've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Could that help? And one of the disciples brought the idea to Jesus. And Jesus said, that's it. Prayed for it, multiplied it. They got to distribute it. They experienced in the ministry. They were the volunteers. They didn't have an usher crew. They didn't have, a hospitality committee. They didn't have a food service corps. God did His thing and let them participate in the ministry. He sent them out. That commissioning that we refer to, that didn't happen after 3 years of sitting under His teaching. That happened fairly early on in their training process. They were sent out. They came back. They debriefed. They went with Him. They experienced with Him. He raised up His volunteers from within. And my personal opinion is, if you're looking to reach kids, far more effective to do it with kids than with well-meaning adults. And if the adults aren't well-meaning to begin with, they don't get it, let them experience the testimony and watch their heart change. You know, at that point, they're going to see kids starting to be transformed to the extent that they're serving other kids. They're going to embrace it at that point. When we started Excel, it was 13 kids between the ages of 14 and 22. I was 21 and the oldest member of the team that was involved day to day. There was one 22-year-old co-founder too, but, he could come when he could. But that was the group, and they were, most of them, like I described earlier. But they were empowered. That's that part about empowering youth leadership. They were empowered. We didn't have space, stuff, cash, any of that stuff, staff. We had kids, and the other thing we did have was a church family that was willing to trust us, a pastor that was willing to let us design and create and implement what we wanted to do, even though we were all unqualified. None of us had youth ministry degrees, or any of that kind. We didn't have theological training or experience, any of that stuff. But we had heart, we had passion, and we wanted to see something happen. The pastor gave us all he could. We were still a church plant, storefront church. We'd have offerings that would take in a couple $100 a week. We had no money. Most of the people in the church were on welfare or living in the projects. So there was no cash to work with. They were all new Christians pretty much. So they weren't about to come and start discipling kids. But they gave us the platform. to raise up leaders from among our group of kids. And it's those kids that started Excel. And these kids that you see are fruit of their investment. This is from this past year, kids getting baptized and putting on shows and all sorts of things. That's fruit of the investment that 13 inner city kids made 9 years ago. There's another principle that Jesus used over and over again with his disciples. They would come to him like after he'd speak in parables and such. I mean, imagine, most of our evangelical outreach methods are cliches, right? The preaching, a lot of our evangelistic efforts, we preach cliches, we make it obvious, we do it in a way that you can't miss it, you know, it's an ABC format, real easy, cookie cutter, simple to understand. Well, Jesus never spoke like that. Right? We do that real well today in our circles. But Jesus, his method of speaking to people was parables. He'd go and he'd tell a story about a seed and then walk away and leave them to figure out what it meant. You know, he'd tell them about a coin that nobody could find and somebody tore up the house looking for it. And then he'd walk away and let them figure out what it meant. But he'd let his life speak for itself to these guys. And they would come to him from time to time and ask him, you know, why do you speak in parables? We don't even understand what you're trying to say. Right? And they were living with him, eating with him, fellowshipping with him. And he said to them, those who have ears to hear are going to hear the message. Those who have eyes to see are going to see the point. Right? Well, looking at it from the point of view of somebody in ministry, those who have eyes to see the need are going to see the need. Those who have ears to hear the heartbeat of the kids, the voice of the kids, are going to respond to that cry. Kids speak in freaking riddles, right? You know, it's very difficult sometimes to understand what's really going on. They start, you know, something's obviously up, and then they start talking about something that seems so random and obscure and irrelevant, but it's their way of getting you to, you know, glimpse the confusion and the angst that's going on in their lives. And we need to have eyes to see and ears to hear what they're really saying. And I love your encouragement to just be available, because if you're not available, you're not going to have ears to hear. You're not going to have eyes to see. You're going to miss the confusion and the questioning and the angst and all of that kind of stuff. But when you're there and you're free from the idea that it's only about what happens at the youth ministry service, you know, and that you have just the right amount of snacks and that the ushers have all done their job perfectly and the message has been presented in exactly the right format and the multimedia went off without a hitch and all this kind of, when you realize it, I mean, all that stuff is great. That's part of the bait in a lot of cases. But at the end of the day, all that could fall apart. As long as you had ears to hear what God wanted to say to the kids and what the kids are feeding you back. As long as you had eyes to see what was going on in their life, to peer into their heart and their soul and go there with them, experience their journey with them. That's when things begin to change. And it is a process. It's going to take time. Peter didn't deny Christ a week out into their relationship. He denied Christ 3 years into their relationship. It was after all this investment. Judas didn't betray Jesus early on. He betrayed him 3 years out into their relationship. So this kind of stuff is going to take time, but that's where, I mean, young people have a lifetime ahead of them, and we are privileged to spend part of that life with them, walking them through this period of discovery that they're all going through. Any other questions, comments?
And the high schoolers want to leave, but our concern is that they're not, we haven't really gotten any great deep practice. They want to leave, I think, just to feel apart. So our concern is that maybe they'll get into that. Because we feel like a lot of time we spend our youth night doing discipline. I spend all my time trying to get these boys to sit still and listen. I can't get a word in edgewise, even to try to tell them anything. So our concern is like, we sent these high schoolers in there, we can't even control them. I mean, we don't. Or they don't have the answers. We'll sit in groups with them and I get almost some of the questions they don't know. So if I have a meeting with kids and they don't know the answers, I agree with what you guys are saying. I want to see these kids take ownership and be a part of that. That's kind of what we've been wrestling with. Like, you just throw them out there and let them fail? Or do you, I mean, I want to protect them.
I think developing leaders is about recognizing gifts and giving opportunities for them to play to their strengths. So one of the things, for example, you know, part of the job of a youth worker is to provide some of the answers. But part of the job of a youth worker is to help identify questions, create a safe space for questioning, for grappling, for wrestling, for asking, for wondering, for exploring, for experimenting, for all that kind of stuff. If kids don't have all the answers, they're probably great to help facilitate questions. You know, to sit down and create that kind of an environment where it's safe to do that. If they're moving around and socializing and talking too much, they're probably great to help facilitate that part of your service or your activity. The part that's interactive, the part that's playful, the part that's fellowship oriented. You play to that strength, but you don't do it necessarily by telling them what their need is. I would suggest to you, if you ask them what their need is, they're going to come back to you with some real insights, you know, with suggestions that are things that we can learn from as much as what they can learn from. I read not too long ago, Leonard Sweet wrote a comment about a book that Brian McLaren wrote called A New Kind of Christian, and he said of the book that it's a great book because it helps us stop asking the question, what would Jesus do? And start recognizing and asking the question, what is Jesus doing? Because in the midst of the confusion and the inability to answer questions and, you know, the distractions and all, even in the midst of that chaos, Jesus is working in their life. And so recognizing what it is that he's doing there and playing to that and giving that an opportunity to grow will allow for the kind of maturation that you want to see so that now they're facilitating a Bible study or getting up behind a pulpit. The other thing I would say, if the goal is, you know, to see kids behind a pulpit, they may not have all the theological points quite developed. But in Revelation, talking about dealing with the attacks of the enemy, John writes that we overcome the world by the blood of the Lamb and the insight of our sermon. No. He didn't say you overcome the world by the blood of the Lamb and the depth of your prayer. He said you overcome the enemy by the blood of the Lamb and the word of your testimony. Even the most distracting teenager who's met Jesus has a testimony. And so you give them the opportunity to share that testimony and that other stuff will begin to, you know, to deal with itself in due time. It is a process that takes some time. You do want to have some discretion about who you're sticking up to present testimonies, because once they do that, they put a bullseye. You put a bullseye on their back, because now they've gotten up, and Satan sees that they've got some potential. You're developing them as a leader. He's going to do what he can to take them out. So you do want to be sensitive to that. But I believe in giving them as much opportunity as they're ready to embrace, and helping them to discover that place in their life. What is that opportunity that they can embrace, the gifts that they do have, and then allowing them to exercise those gifts so that they become stronger and more effective. Well, I'm looking at the clock, and we just went a minute over time. So we are, we're done. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure meeting you.